Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I'm joined by our news editor, Jordan Farley.
Hello.
Whose name on the Zoom is The Shape. See what he's done there? And our contributor...
This is my inner character coming
it
out.
Is. I'm glad you're virtually there and not really here, then, if that's the case. And our contributor, Layla Latif, who is just Layla. She's not channeling any horror maestros today.
It's a real shame because I did manage to put my Twitter as a spooky name and I didn't think as far as my Zoom, but you know, how terrible of me, really.
I know. Sorry to let you all down. Get more creative in these Halloween times. Okay, so this week we are, unsurprisingly, talking Halloween Kills, Venom, Ron's Gone Wrong, The Last Duel and The Beta Test. Potato, potato.
I would, beta. I'm not American, so.
Anyway, that one. But before we get to those, what are you watching at the moment? What have you been feasting your eyes on, Layla?
I am doing what all of the cool kids are doing and watching Squid Game, which is the Korean TV show where a load of people who have got terrible debt problems go and do sort of childhood games. And if you get caught out, you get killed. And there's sort of a bit of organ trafficking and a bit of murder and a bit of, you know, satirical commentary on capitalism and everything, and I'm just having so much fun with it to the extent that I just got an invitation to the London Korean Film Festival and I'm going to go to that. It just seems like all of the stuff coming out of South Korea for the past couple of years has been so incredible. Like, they're really good at like that high concept stuff and just action and like big ideas as well, and kind of genre bending. Like, I just, I'm having a great time with Squid Game.
Also, just to say that the Korean Film Festival always has excellent food.
Sold.
So it's always a reason to go. Jordan, what have you been watching?
Yeah, I've been watching Squid Game as well, of course, like everyone else on the planet, now that it's
Netflix's obligatory. You have to.
Show ever. Yeah, exactly. I managed to binge that and Midnight Mass in one weekend, which was a very sort of horror-packed weekend, a very enjoyable weekend. But most recently, I watched Maid, also on Netflix, the Margaret Qualley show.
Ah, yes, I'm watching that. I'm loving Andy McDowell in it.
To quote a line from No Time to Die, she's like a bag of bees. She's absolutely nuts in that show.
Yes.
Very enjoyable, though. I've never seen her quite so unhinged, but yeah, she's a lot of fun. I think that show's terrific. I've seen it all now, and I don't think I've ever seen Margaret Qualley better. Found it quite moving.
That's my current thing that I'm watching, and I'm loving seeing the real mother-daughter thing, but played out completely nutso. And yeah, I think Margot Qualley, I've liked her in things, but I think this is actually where she's really found her groove. And also, I'm like, why hasn't Andy McDowell been used as a nutbag before? She's, you know, like, why were we trying to force her into the, you know, the Four Weddings and a Funeral rom-com mold? She should have been doing madness way before. She's cracking at it. And also last night, I went to see Frozen the Musical. Ooh. And I'd just say magical. Absolutely.
I've got that booked for Christmas time. And I want to see how they do the dress reveal. I've heard it's amazing.
No spoilers, but it's one of those things that when you go to the theatre and you're used to seeing special effects and magical things happen in films and it's seamless, to see something happen in front of your very eyes, I literally was gasping like a child. I was like, when her dress changed, or when the ice went up the walls, or, you know, snow came down from the ceiling. It's properly like a magic show when it happens in front of your eyes. I loved it.
Opposite experience to Diana the musical. I don't know if you've seen that on Netflix.
I haven't.
That is a real so bad it's amazing sort of thing. But they have a really bizarre special effect where they kind of magic Diana into her wedding dress, and it is amazing and like astonishingly crap at the same time.
Sold. Next, I'm putting that on my list. So good recommendations. Okay, shall we crack on then with what we can see on the big screen? It's time to face the boogeyman.
Michael Myers is flesh and blood, but a man couldn't have survived that fire. The more he kills, the more he transcends.
Run! Go home now!
He's the essence of evil.
So this is Halloween Kills. Jordan, where are we when we get back into Haddonfield?
Pretty much immediately where Halloween 2018 ends. So this film is picking up on the very same Halloween night, 2018, where Michael Myers returned to Haddonfield 40 years after his original rampage. If you've seen Halloween 2018, mild spoilers, you'll know at the end of that film that three generation of Strode women, Laurie, Karen, and Allison, trapped Michael in Laurie's purpose-built Michael Myers trap basement, seemingly to burn alive. But, you know, this is a Halloween sequel, so of course Michael escapes and embarks on another rampage of blood and grue, and every kind of bit of viscera you can imagine is pretty much spilled in this film. If you've seen Halloween 2018, you'll also remember that at the end of that film, Laurie gets stabbed in the stomach. So for much of this film, Laurie herself is in hospital, and a surprising amount of this film takes place in Haddonfield General Hospital, where the townsfolk are none too happy that Michael Myers has escaped and is killing people again, and led by Tommy Doyle, played by Anthony Michael Hall, who you may remember as the young boy who Laurie is babysitting in the original Halloween film directed by John Carpenter. He
also in Weird Science. You know, I thought you were going to go
Science,
there.
Of course, yeah. Breakfast Club. You know, the muse of John Hughes for a while. Looking a lot tougher, a lot meaner in this film than you're probably used to him being. He leads a sort of lynch mob trying to track down Michael and kill him to the cries of "Evil Dies Tonight," which is a thing that is repeated a lot in this film.
It is.
I would say that this is where the first Halloween sequel, Halloween 2018. It's very confusing to talk about these films because they're both called Halloween.
You have to put the release dates with the year.
You know what we're talking about. Whereas that film was sort of half reboot, half sequel, dialed up the humor a lot. This is a much nastier, much more vicious film. It's called Halloween Kills, perhaps for a reason. He kills an awful lot of people in his film, like just insane death toll in this film. And the gore effects are probably some of the most disgusting gore effects I've ever seen in a film. I was wincing at a lot of them. People get stabbed in the eye.
There's so many horrible things happen.
It tries to say something about mob violence and taking the law into your own hands and where that's appropriate. I don't think it does it particularly subtly, which is a shame, because I did think that Halloween 2018 did some quite interesting things with like generational trauma and what it meant to live with the consequences of a violent massacre like this and what that does to a person. But with this, it just felt a lot more simplistic and quite silly in places. But I will say I was up for watching Michael Myers kill a lot of people, and I got that in droves. So for me, it was a partial success.
Layla, were you up for seeing Michael Myers kill people in droves? How did it work for you?
Yeah, I watched this on the final day, I think, of Venice, and it was like I was sort of hanging on by a thread, and it was 8 a.m. and they'd already announced that there was going to be a sequel. So I was like, well, nothing can happen then. What is the point of this film? Like, it's going to, we know that Laurie and Michael at the very least are going to be okay. So rock bottom expectations. And then I just thought it was really, really good fun. I guess it's that funny thing that like where Michael Myers in the first Halloween is like such an intensely scary and disturbing presence. And then over all of these sequels and reboots and kind of semi-sequels and reimaginings, like he sort of becomes slightly almost endearing. Like it's kind of nice to see him again. Like I've got a weird nostalgia for Michael Myers.
You're like pop around mine for a cup of tea.
Well, not quite, but more that like he can't be quite as disturbing a thing anymore to me because he's familiar. So it worked for me that it's just like, oh, we're gonna just, this is just going to be ludicrous. Like this man is, I think he's got to be almost 70. He's basically invincible. I don't want to give any spoilers away, but he's basically invincible and they acknowledge that. And so just kind of going in for like these really gruesome tableaus and like ludicrous kills and just like, you know, we're not going to bother doing any power of suggestion. We're just going to show you. And then these like slightly funny quirks, like I really like Little John and Big John, the couple that were living in the house. And I liked what that kind of said about how people can get a little bit gruesome with murder sites and sort of like, you know, grisly tourism and that sort of thing. And I think Judy Greer and Jamie Lee Curtis were really great. I think some of the actors that were in the sort of lynch mob weren't so strong. I actually think Anthony Michael Hall was pretty rubbish, if I'm honest.
Pretty rubbish is how I describe the whole thing, frankly.
I can see that. I don't know that I could like argue that it's a masterpiece, but I had a great time.
I didn't. I really didn't like this whole idea. I mean, for me, there's nothing more terrifying than Michael Myers standing in the laundry in the back garden in the original film and then just disappearing. And you're like, did I see him? Why is he motionless? His just blank face, everything about it. It's just absolutely diminishing returns for me through all of the various sequels and now to this. I also liked, I think I have to accept that I liked him as a real man and not a boogeyman, not like a invincible man who can walk through gates that are locked, etc., and appear regardless of being burnt to the ground and what have you, and have the strength of 10 men and take on, you know, 11 firemen and still walk away from the scene. I think I prefer it as the psychological sort of thing of Michael Myers being a real man who is just in a frenzy, and that's something I can recognise as terrifying if that was to come to your house. So to take away from that, it just puts it into this complete fantasy for me. And then I don't want that then with weird social messages thrown in, like trying to say, oh, but, you know, lynch mobs and, you know, storming the Capitol and who we are as a society, shall we examine that? Well, no, because that's not the film you're making. You can't have your cake and eat it. I don't want that in the middle of just like brain slicing. So I found it very unsatisfying and really grim, actually. You say, Layla, you know he's coming back. So it's just like, where is the sort of fear of this? It's just like, well, these people are done for and that one's definitely had it. She's getting nowhere running like that. And maybe I wasn't in the right frame of mind.
But didn't you think there was some sort of interesting ideas around the fact that these people had survived Michael Myers and they sort of had a desire to be killed by him? Like, because even like there's some moments where like they're almost acknowledging like, cool, I'm going to go and walk into this house now armed with like barely anything to take on an unstoppable person. Wish me luck. And like, I think they had a thing about like, oh no, these people have, they're not
like
stupid.
A weird
they've
death
got a
wish.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess
maybe
so.
That's generous of me.
I think you're giving it more intelligence than it has, because I think it was just like, let's do kills. What could we lace over the top that would make it feel like it had something to say? But actually it has nothing to say. It's just like, turn up to the cinema with your popcorn, try not to dry heave into it when some things happen, and enjoy, which I totally see that that's attractive as well. But I don't want it served up to me as social commentary. Also, Jamie Lee Curtis, I wanted more of her.
She is very underserved by this film. Yeah, you really get the sense that they're saving a lot of her stuff for Halloween Ends, for whatever the third film will be. She basically does nothing, which is a shame. Like, she just lies in hospital for most of it, which is a very odd choice. I mean, the interesting thing that they do that we've touched on there is that they brought a lot of characters back from Halloween 1978. Obviously, Tommy Doyle, not originally played by Anthony Michael Hall, but a lot of the people who originally played these characters are playing them again, like Lee Brackett, played by Charles Cyphers, Lindsay, played by Kyle Richards.
Real Housewives of Beverly Hills.
Exactly.
Donald Pleasance they've brought back, even though obviously he hasn't turned up in person. But
Of course not. He's actually played by one of the art department who just happens to look almost identical
it's
to
creepy.
Donald Pleasance, which is an uncanny resemblance. It's quite incredible. Yeah, he features in these. They're briefly teased in the trailer, so it's not a huge spoiler to say, but there are brief sequences actually set in 1978, originally after the original Halloween film, which also features Jim Cummings, who will be popping up again later in this podcast.
Effort, I think, than we will be discussing later.
Yeah, I thought that stuff was quite interesting. I got a real thrill from seeing just how accurately they'd kind of recreated the mask in that sequence. I was like, wow, that looks exactly like it did in Carpenter's film. That's quite incredible. And they really recreate the vibe quite well of the original film. So I got a bit of a buzz from those sequences. They were quite fun. It definitely feels like half of a film that is a bit of a problem here, because you feel like you don't really get a particularly satisfying payoff at the end. I thought what Halloween 2018 did particularly well was have just a terrific ending. Like, it really left you on a high, that film. But this film just ends on a little bit of a sour note, because you know there's more to come.
It's the year for it. If you're going to be upset with that, you're not going to enjoy June, are you?
I felt like June felt a bit more complete, if I'm honest, than this did. Because, as I say, Laurie Strode gets nothing to do. Like, at least find her something to do in this film. Like, if you're going to do anything, you have to give her something. And not doing anything with Jamie Lee Curtis just feels like such a waste.
She does a lot of talking and nonsensical talking, which I'm going to blame on the meds. But, like, oh, you know, he's not this. It's us. It's fear. Oh, wait, it's not fear. It's this. Evil must die. Die, evil. Tonight, evil must die. Dying evil, evil tonight. Like, just, I think she'd had too much morphine, really. But, yeah, there was a lot of nonsensical blabbering and sort of portentous twaddle being spoken, wasn't there?
I mean, she must have been also blood loss, because this whole film is the same night as the first one. Mm. So, and it's not light by the end of it. So we've got to think this film is maybe 3 hours
after it, yeah.
Real time. So from stabbing, surgery, I mean, it's quite impressive you'd be even as coherent as to say evil dies tonight.
Which everybody does say a lot. Okay, so are we recommending this one for a, you know, Friday night popcorn movie? Good one to go with the gang?
I think if you have low expectations, they will probably be exceeded. Which is what happened to me. I know what you mean about it doesn't have an ending, but because I knew that didn't bother me so much. So yeah, I think it's fun. I think if you like a slasher thing and you can't wait for, you know, Scream 5, which is actually called Scream, because that's what we do with our sequels now.
Yeah, like, we just call them the original thing to confuse everybody.
It's so weird.
I would give it a tentative thumbs up if you, A, really love horrible practical gore effects, you'll get a lot out of this. And if you, B, really like John Carpenter's music, you'll really enjoy this. But otherwise, it was a little bit of a step down from Halloween 2018 for me, which is obviously a big step down from Halloween 1978. So,
yeah, I mean, I would just say watch the original and just enjoy the master at work there. Okay, so Halloween Kills is out in cinemas on Friday the 15th, just in time for Halloween itself. Okay, shall we go on to another killer on the streets then? With this.
Eddie Brock, I want to give you my story. People love serial killers.
Cletus, why me?
What's mine is yours. And what's yours is mine. I have tasted blood before, and that is not it. All I ever wanted in this world is carnage.
So this is Venom. Let there be carnage. See what they did there. Layla, tell us about this one. Tell us how carnage is getting in on the act.
Right. So we left off at the last Venom with Eddie Brock, with his career in ruins, going to meet Woody Harrelson's Cletus Cassidy, who's a infamous serial killer in prison in, where is it, San Francisco that they live in?
San Francisco, yes. Yeah.
Which is worth mentioning, because it is an insane plot detail that happens. He's going to go and interview him, and Eddie manages to figure out, with the help of Venom, where perhaps some of the unsolved murders that Cletus Cassidy performed, some evidence for them, which then leads to Cletus Cassidy getting the death penalty. And they specify that they have changed California's laws in order to
retrofit this. Yeah.
Eddie is sort of living in a bit of a detente with Venom. They're sort of become a strange bickering couple, and Venom wants to eat brains, and Eddie keeps trying to give him chickens. Then he gets him two chickens called Sonny and Cher, but Venom doesn't want to eat them because he thinks of them as pets. So they're kind of having a fractious relationship, and Cletus Kasady manages to get a tiny bit of symbiote blood, and so he becomes Carnage, which is basically just a big red venom. It's absolutely batshit, this film. And I would give it both 1 and 5 stars.
Wow.
Because it is as terrible as it is fantastic. I'm kind of obsessed with it. A film that for no reason has Venom go to a rave. I think Tom Hardy has incredible chemistry with himself, but it is also bad. Like, it is, yeah, like, it makes very little sense. It's sort of, plot points are ludicrous. They're really, really, really bad wigs. Naomi Harris and Stephen Graham are criminally underused, but like, I laughed out loud like 60 times. And in 90 minutes, it's just so bizarre and freaky and funny that, yes, 1 star and 5 stars at the same time.
Jordan, which end of the scale are you going?
I mean, I'm much closer to the 1 star perspective, if I'm honest. I would scrape it a 2 just because I do find Venom quite enjoyable as a character. Like, I find all his bizarre quips and interjections just, yeah, genuinely quite amusing. But apart from that, I thought this was dreadful. The story just didn't make any sense. Like, I just didn't even understand Carnage. Like, so if a bit of Eddie's blood gets in someone else, it creates another symbiote that is like another character. Why is Carnage so powerful compared to Venom? Why is he red?
Yeah.
He's seemingly Venom's son or something. Like, what the hell is going on? Like, I just didn't get any of it. The structure of the film is just incredibly bizarre as well, because you don't get like an actual confrontation between Venom and Carnage until like literally right at the end. So it feels like there's at least one set piece missing in the middle of the film where you get some kind of head-to-head between them. So you don't even get like the satisfaction of decent action out of this. And when the action does come, it's just incredibly murky and chaotic, and you can't really tell what's going on half the time. And the visual effects just didn't quite do it for me this time around. Like, I know they weren't brilliant in the first film, but they weren't much better here. Tom Hardy kind of, all his tics and mannerisms just rubbed me the wrong way a bit this time. I did quite enjoy his performance in the first film, like jumping in the lobster tank and stuff, just so strange and off kilter. And I loved those weird choices, but here it just felt a tiny bit too forced. Like, we were just seeing something that was, people just thought, oh, they like that in the first one, let's do
more
of it. Yeah, it felt a little bit like that to me this time around. Yeah, what is Naomi Harris doing in this film? Like, such an accomplished actress, like, has absolutely nothing to do here. Just screams a lot. That's basically it. Weird. Just such a strange film.
Yeah, you're not selling it to me. I was at Frozen rather than seeing this. And I mean, the other thing that's telling about this is there were no screenings for press in advance of last night. With it being out this week. It feels like that often denotes a film that the studio doesn't have much confidence in. And do you think that people are going to be, you know, like going out to see it on the Layla model? I just want to go see something so terrible that I love it. Or should you save your money?
I think people genuinely like Venom, right? I think they just like that character. Like, he's the dark mirror image of Spider-Man, and everyone freaking loves Spider-Man. So of course people are going to go and see the new Venom film. And even though the first film got a bit of a critical kicking, I liked it slightly more than most critics seem to. It obviously did incredibly well at the box office, like made almost $900 million, I think, which is crazy. That was more than, you know, the Amazing Spider-Man films were making, the Andrew Garfield films. So there's a lot of affection for this character. And you may have heard a lot of buzz about the post-credit scene in this film as well, which I would say for me was by far like the most exciting thing about this film. The post-credit scene is like a huge deal. It's worth seeing just to see that bit and not have it spoiled for you before word gets out everywhere.
And before it leads to other projects, we should say.
Yeah, there's some very exciting potential for what could come next based on the post-credit scene. But the film itself, I thought was quite rubbish, if I'm honest.
I mean, I think Layla sold it to anybody intrigued as a 1 5-star movie.
It's a rare 1-star, 5-star movie.
So if you want to go and check that out and tell us which end of the sliding scale you are on, it is out in cinemas this Friday. Right, shall we give the bloodletting a rest and feel warm and cozy instead with this.
Hi, insert registered name. I am your
my B-bot. B-bot.
The B-bot, there's something wrong with it. It's not meant to do that.
I'm not meant to do that. I am for making friends. Does Barney need friends?
Well, yeah. Or, fun fact, he will not survive middle school.
This is Ron's Gone Wrong, Jordan. I feel like this would be right up your street. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so this is the debut film from a brand new British animation studio called Locksmith. They've basically been set up to be a British Pixar, essentially a British DreamWorks, because believe it or not, Britain doesn't have a dedicated CG animation studio. So anyway, this is set in America, perhaps unsurprisingly. It stars Jack Dylan Grazer as Barney. He's a middle schooler, and in the world that he lives in, everyone has a tiny little robot pal called a B-bot. They're essentially like a kind of physical manifestation of social media. They follow you around, they're friends, they post all your videos, they like things. It's basically hell is what I would think of this, but everyone seems very happy about it in this world. But Barney is pretty much the only person in school who doesn't have a B-bot. His father, he's a single dad. He works from home. He's a bit of a schlub, played by Ed Helms, and his Bulgarian grandma called Donka. They don't see the appeal of B-bots. They're very much a traditional kind of family, growing vegetables in the back garden. They have a goat in the back garden. But Barney desperately wants one, and his father and his grandmother see this, so they manage to get him one. Unfortunately, it's one that's literally fallen off the back of a van and is a bit broken, and he's called Ron, and he's played by Zach Galifianakis. And instead of being this amazing technical creation that knows everything about their owner or can do all these incredible things, Ron is like the MS-DOS to everyone else's like iPhone, essentially. He's broken, he can't do anything, he doesn't know anything about Barney, he only knows the alphabet up to the letter B, so he can't even say Barney's name. So it becomes about them building this friendship. It's very much in the ET mold. Ron is a kind of outlaw creation because he doesn't have the source code that everyone else has. He can essentially do what he wants and break all the rules. He can hit people. He can do anything, basically. So this is a real threat to the tech conglomerate that created him. And yeah, it essentially becomes about Barney and Ron, they're building friendship and that being threatened by outside forces. I did find this a lot of fun, actually, in a sort of similar vein to Venom. The best thing about it is this central, strange character, Ron, played by Zach Galifianakis, who's just this just bizarre blank slate of a character, just has this very endearing manner about him where he doesn't know anything, but he's really trying to be friends with Barney. Like, he just doesn't get it, but he goes about it in all the wrong ways, but it's quite sweet. His ultimate goal, he just really wants to try and please Barney. The reason that it fell kind of short for me is, it's just E.T. like, it's literally just E.T. as an animated movie, which is not particularly innovative or adventurous, and it has a weird amount in common with The Mitchells versus the Machines, the film that came out on Netflix earlier this year.
Including Olivia Colman.
Yeah, Olivia Colman's in both, which is odd. And they both end with a kind of big confrontational climax at a kind of fancy tech headquarters. There's a weird amount of overlap, and this never felt as innovative or interesting as that film did. It felt very much like they were trying to beat Pixar and DreamWorks and all those studios at their own game, and it felt like this was very much a sort of first effort. It felt like the kind of film Pixar was making around the early 2000s, if I'm honest. But Ron's a great character. I enjoyed him a lot. If you take a kid along, I'm sure they'll love Ron and they'll want all the Ron toys when they come home. But this was a sort of decent start, but nothing particularly amazing as far as I'm concerned.
I think I liked it more than you did, Jordan. I totally agree with you about the crossover with the Mitchells versus the Machines. You can totally see that. And I did sort of wonder about the sort of making Olivia Colman this strange granny doing a funny accent. It felt a little bit like it might be not okay. But I thought it was very, very sweet, and it did win me over, and it warmed the cockles of my heart. And there are some sort of really quite funny moments, mostly from Ron and Zach doing the voice there. He's repetitive and annoying and silly. He has a heart of gold, even though he doesn't have a heart. He's just full of wires, but he's just a chip. It's sort of like a dog, isn't he? An electronic dog. He doesn't really understand what he's doing, but he just wants to please you. I did like how they explored, you know, that the idea that everybody's got something and this kid doesn't, and he feels left out. And what do you do as a parent, and how do you do that? And as a child struggling to make friends, I thought for kids that do struggle to connect with other kids or do feel that they don't have what other kids have, there's a lot of warmth and comfort in watching this film. So I thought that was really good. And I just think half-term films, it's not like having to see Paw Patrol, the movie, is it? If you're an adult taking a child out and you're going to see a movie, this is not a bad way to spend 90 minutes of your day. It's not actually where you're going to have a snooze. You might really quite enjoy it yourself. So I think it's a good one.
I don't disagree with any of that. All I would say is that, yeah, this film is really positioning itself as kind of competition to what Pixar is doing, basically. And I don't think it's anywhere near that level. But definitely a step up from Paw Patrol.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, and just brace yourself for like a terrible Liam Payne song that plays.
Oh god, I'd forgotten that.
Well.
I wiped that from my memory, but yes,
just horrendous. Yeah. Like, I immediately got up and walked out.
Did you?
At the credits.
Oh, okay. All right.
Watched the entire film, and
yes.
Then I left.
Okay, fine. Yeah. Because I was like, wow, that's really critical to storm out of a child's film. But okay. Okay, so that is Ron's Gone Wrong, which is out in cinemas for half term on Friday. Okay, so let's just do our plain talking for this week, which is where we try to demystify terms that are said on film sets. The one we're talking about this week is picture car. What's a picture car, Jordan?
Pretty simply, this is the hero car. This is the, you know, top of the call sheet car. This is the Aston Martin DB5 without the scratches on, without the battle damage, you know. It's the one that your main actors will get in and do their insert shots in, all that kind of stuff. Yeah, it's the one that is going to be on the poster or in all the stills. Like it's that car, basically. It's the one that's kept pristine.
Perfect. Let's move on from present-day pals with Ron's Gone Wrong to the 14th century enemies of this.
A most unspeakable charge has been brought against you.
Jacques Legris entered our home. He attacked me.
The accusation is false.
I am telling the truth.
The truth does not matter. There is only the power of men.
This should be settled quietly.
I'm innocent!
I request a duel to the death.
If you lose, your wife will suffer dire consequences.
One of us has lied. Let us let God decide.
So this is the last duel. Layla, who is fighting who?
So this is based on the last ever trial by combat, which happened in 1386 and was between a man called Jean de Carogue and Jacques Legris. That is about as good as the accents are in the film. So
I think you're doing much better than anyone on the screen.
There was a dispute because, I mean, I might just call them by their actor names. Matt Damon is married to the wonderful Jodie Comer, and his kind of friend turned rival, Adam Driver, rapes her. And they have to then, in order to settle this, have a trial by combat. And the idea of a trial by combat is that God is deciding the victor and is kind of being the judge of who is guilty and not guilty. So if Matt Damon loses the fight, then that is going to mean that Jodie Comer's character will be burned at the stake, because that will be proof that this was a false allegation of rape. Mm. And it's done Rashomon style, I suppose, would be the easiest way to describe it, that the kind of same events are told from three different characters' point of views. So in each section of it, it is the way that they view the world and the way that they view themselves and the way that they view their other characters. And I thought that was one of the best things about the film, is that they're essentially all giving three different performances, depending on who is perceiving them. The difference between it and Rashomon is, I think with Rashomon, you're fundamentally this idea that the truth is unknowable and there is this nebulous thing and who's to say what the correct version of events is. This film very much takes up a position that there is somebody who is telling the truth more so than other people, and that is Jodie Comer's character. Because, and I think that was a really interesting idea, because even in like modern day justice and stuff, there is this kind of like, oh, she said, he said, who can we possibly know who is saying the right thing? But it's just like, well, is it this kind of brutish knight who with nothing to lose, or is it the woman who's like staking her reputation, her life,
her life,
willing to be burned at the stake? You know, we shouldn't kind of give their accounts equal weight, I suppose. But yeah, I didn't have particularly high expectations going into it, because right from the beginning, the accents weren't great and the hair is very dodgy. But I really, really enjoyed it. And I thought the way that it kind of did stuff with form and the performances, and Ben Affleck's really funny. Yeah, I thought it was great.
Ben Affleck's really funny. Let's discuss that, shall we? You found that funny haha or funny peculiar?
Funny peculiar.
Okay, good. Because I don't know what he was going for in this. I can only assume he sat down to watch The King, saw Robert Pattinson, and thought, I want a piece of that. I want to come into a film where everyone else is like doing it seriously, but with peroxide hair, doing an accent that's neither French, neither British, neither American, and say rude words at the drop of a hat for a comedic value. I didn't get this at all. And especially I find it weird when I know he wrote it. He and Matt Damon co-wrote it with Nicole Holofcena, and that they each took part of this three-story sort of format and they each wrote a part of it. And it's like, wow, I don't know what's going on here. That was the least of my worries, because as you say, my big beefs are accents and hair. And I don't mind people not sort of doing French. Although, to be honest, I think I would have preferred this with Vincent Cassel and people actually doing it in French. But can we all agree what we're going for? Like, Adam Driver decided to do one thing. Matt Damon decided to not bother. Affleck decided to go British. I don't know what Harriet Walter's accent was. Was that French? Was that German? What was she going for? I don't know. So there's that, which just totally takes me out of it. Matt Damon's hair. Do we have historical evidence that mullets of this severity that would be fine in Hoxton were a thing? I didn't understand that. And then poor old Jodie Comer, who's flipping fantastic, reduced to a woman that just quivers in various beautiful dresses in corners in different scenes, just quivering very, very well. And then there's this idea of having to see a rape twice, brutally, in two different accounts. Do I need to see it in the third account? I've already seen it. Why do I have to watch that again? Could I not have seen a different side of that experience? I didn't think it was as feminist as it thought it was. And so all of that felt like a bit of a mess to me. So I didn't enjoy it as much as you, I'm afraid.
I am surprised that you didn't find the whole Ben Affleck thing quite amusing, because as soon as I knew that they were doing this Rashomon thing of like different perspectives, and like you kind of get Matt Damon's one and it's just like, oh, this Ben Affleck character is a weird guy. I wonder what he's like from everyone else's perspective. And then the second one comes just like, weird dude. And then the third one is like, no, still weird.
Yeah. Still weird.
I was like, oh, okay, we're just all agreed that like this king's cousin is just this kind of quite unsettling blonde guy
who apparently has access to peroxide in the 13th century.
But you know me, I like a weird choice. I like blonde for no reason.
I just feel like this would have been better had it actually been a French film. And I find the casting and the showboating really quite distracting. And at the heart of this is a really interesting story. Like, and I also think it's more about her story. It tries to lean towards that. But can you imagine making an accusation against a powerful man when, you know, the result of you being found guilty by a random act is that you are burnt alive at the stake. And somebody actually says, you know, people do take 20 to 30 minutes to die, and they're sort of conscious for this. And it's like, can you imagine even making that accusation and what that means to somebody, and why you would do that, and why you would feel so strongly that this rape should be shown for what it is, and that men of this era should be shown for what it is. I think that's a really, really interesting story, but I didn't find that in this film.
Did you even find Jodie Comer like a bit underwhelming in the final act? Because I thought, you know, when it was from the other men's perspective, like she is a bit nothing. But then when I thought she took center stage, that to me was like when the film really...
but that's only a third of the film. The rest of the time she's quivering beautifully in the corner. She's the best thing in it for me. And I think it shows how great she is. But I wanted more from it. Maybe Ridley just didn't have the time to really concentrate on it because he's just banging them out. He's got House of Gucci next. He's just got a lot on his plate. So, you know.
Two films in 1 year. Not bad.
Yeah. And so also this did suffer from the whole COVID shutdown, didn't it? Because they were halfway through doing it. Massive shutdown. Matt Damon got stranded in Ireland and was going swimming off the coast of Ireland with his Tesco's carrier bag. And they all had to wait until they could all come back and finish it.
Talking about his amazing Airbnb or whatever.
Yeah.
What is the duel like? Obviously. Oh. A big deal if you're going to name it after a duel.
It starts with a bit of the duel and then we go back to the duel, and the duel is great. I mean, much like the film, Jane is making me question my own version of events. But I thought the duel was good because I think it sort of got into like the how horrible something like that is. Like actually going on a horse towards someone with a lance and like having to actually kill someone when they're like encased in layers of metal, so it's not very easy to do. Like, that is an incredibly punishing act. So I like that it got into that. I did think it was a bit funny that like they were also kind of grisly and cold, and like Jodie Comer just always looked like she was coming off a fashion shoot.
Yeah, I mean, she looks she does look great in the scaffolding with the fire behind underneath her, ready to go. She looks wonderful.
That woman had 21st century grooming.
Yeah, she did. Great wig as well. Yeah, the duel is amazing. And, you know, like, this is the guy that brought us Gladiator, and that's where the film comes alive for me, in those action sequences. There's also some quite bloody war that goes on in Limoges. And, you know, it's that, you know, 360 blood splattering across the camera, visceral feeling of what the horror and the mud and the gore of being in a hand-to-hand combat. And also the duel is, you know, historically accurate. I did go and check all of the facts of this film afterwards to ensure, like, could this person really survive that, and would that happen? And yes, all of the things that happened in the duel did actually happen and were documented by court scribes of the time. So it's quite incredible to think this event, and it was an event, this was a duel that the king attended. Loads of crowds came out. It was sort of just outside Paris. And people went out for the day to watch two men go at it on their horses with swords and lances and everything else, to watch somebody die. And that's probably the strongest part of the film for me.
Yeah, and you know that they would have stuck around for the burning at the stake afterwards. I mean, what is wrong with humanity?
Oh, yeah. Maybe some of them were probably disappointed. They're like, I came all this way out of Paris and didn't even get a burning. But you do get other horrible things that happen to people post event. So it's quite a melancholy film, and it does obviously have a lot of modern day things to say about blame culture and rape and, you know, the value of women and women as currency. So there is that.
Yeah. And I also thought kind of an interesting look at who gets to write history in a way, because from what I understand, like, this is a very famous event in French history, and like, it's often been debated up until, you know, nowadays, like, oh, who will know, and, you know, who's to say what really happened, and analyzing what they think. And it's like so patently obvious that, like, no, nobody is, you know, risking themselves being immolated to make a false accusation. But there is like that kind of, even like in the history books, about like, who can ever say?
Yes, yes. Was she put up to it? Aside from anything else, whether I liked it as much as you did, there's plenty to talk about with this film, isn't there? Are you going to go and see it, Jordan? You're a massive Ridley Scott fan.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I just haven't had a chance to see it up till now, but I'll definitely be watching it this weekend. Yeah, very excited.
And then we'll have a WhatsApp chat about what we think's going on. And you can talk about the accents with me. Okay, so that is
could be the third Rashomon-style perspective.
Yes, and then we'll do a film about it. Okay, so that is The Last Duel, and that is out on the big screen. It does look beautiful, I have to say, in cinemas on Friday. Final film of the week, then. It's this one.
A couple of weeks ago, I got a letter in the mail inviting me to a no-strings-attached sexual encounter in a hotel room. It's a pretty card, looked official. I don't know. I was stupid. I went.
What? Dude, this is nuts.
I had to wear a blindfold. But the woman, I can't even tell you.
Wait. What's going on here? Hold on. Wait, this is really happening? You really did this? In this climate?
So this is the beta test. Jordan, come on, tell us about it.
Yeah, so this is the latest film from Jim Cummings and PJ McCabe. You may have seen Thunder Road, their film from a few years ago. What do I want to say about the film? Oh, I don't want to say anything about the film. You may have seen that film from a few years ago. So this once again stars Cummings as a character called Jordan, Jordan Hines. Which is a shame that he's taken my name, because I didn't like this character or this film, if I'm honest. He plays a kind of Hollywood, how do they describe it? It's like a packaging agent.
Yeah.
I wasn't entirely clear what his role was supposed to be, but he's effectively like the middle management layer of Hollywood agents who packages deals and sells them on to people or something like that. It's never made particularly clear. Anyway, he receives this letter in this fancy purple envelope, inviting him to a rendezvous in a hotel room with a secret admirer.
A sexual rendezvous,
exactly. Which he, despite being engaged to a seemingly quite lovely partner, he goes along to anyway, being incredibly unfaithful because he's that kind of guy. He has this sexual encounter, and it's kind of a life-changing moment for him. He becomes obsessed with this woman. He becomes obsessed with finding out who she is. He suspects everyone around him, maybe this person he had a rendezvous in the hotel room with, because they're both wearing masks, so he doesn't know who it is. And from there, he starts tracking down who delivered the envelope, what's going on, why has he been invited to this room, is this an isolated incident, or is this part of a wider plan? And it kind of has a bit of a message at the end, but I just thought overall this was quite poor, to be honest. I didn't really like Cummings's performance. I felt he was showboating throughout the entire film, just zero subtlety to the performance at all. It's a very kind of inside baseball sort of Hollywood film as well, because it's about these packaging agents, and there's a lot of talk about like writers' guilds and all this kind of stuff. So it feels like quite a smug film that he's almost made for people in Hollywood, and not just for normal audiences who might want to enjoy this film, because I found it very difficult to enjoy on that level. Overall, it felt quite amateur to me. There was some attempts at interesting visuals, but apart from that, it just felt almost student movie-like to me. I really didn't get on with this. It felt like a complete waste of time to me.
So that's Jordan's take. I want to hear what Layla has to say. She's sitting there with a very judgy face, and I feel like we're getting ready. Let's go.
I didn't dislike it as much as Jordan. Oh. I just felt that it was just a completely like wasted opportunity, because in the first 20 minutes or so, it starts with a grisly murder, and then there's kind of some shadowy organizations. And I do find that sort of laceration of that entourage kind of manager quite interesting. And that I didn't hate the performance that much. I think he kind of layers in levels of self-loathing amongst all that kind of alpha male bravado that I thought was reasonably interesting. But then I watched it 2 days ago with my husband, and we this morning over breakfast I was literally like, what was that film about? And then I checked my screener to just check the end where the kind of, you reveal. Know like the evil reveal, and I still don't fully know. I love that sort of Black Mirror, Twilight Zone sort of thing. So kind of maybe as I was watching it at the beginning, I was like, this shouldn't be a film. This should be an episode of one of those shows. But then those shows always actually do have quite a clear concept. And by the end of this, I was just like, oh, this is just kind of nonsense.
Yeah,
I do disagree that Jim Cummings' performance was terrible because I think it was decent.
Yeah, I'm on the Jordan side with this. Yeah. I thought it was terrible. He started at 10. There was no nuance at all whatsoever. And and the other thing I thought with this was, if you want to watch this film, there's a way better one that's already been done called The Player. And this doesn't add anything at all to that concept of a Hollywood person with power who thinks they have everything, does something dodgy one night and unravels spectacularly, and does that within this sort of artifice of Hollywood and who is powerful, who people like you based on what you can do for them, all of that sort of stuff is much better done by Robert Altman. And this felt like a very, very low grade student version of that. If you told me that somebody had made this for £1,000 whilst they were studying at UCLA, I'd believe you. It just felt extremely low budget and just copying other things we've seen before that are better. So I like Jim. You know, I think he does some good stuff in Halloween. I can see he can act with nuance and light and shade. And Thunder Road, I thought, had real promise. But again, that was another one that started out quite strong and intriguing and then just withered away to nothing. So yeah, I'm sort of waiting for him to impress me because I feel like there's something there, but this isn't the film that's showing that.
God, it's a bad sign that when Jordan started recapping, I was just like, "Ooh, excellent, I'll find out like
what it was about."
Yeah. And I've seen it like 1.5 times now.
It felt like to me they were going for almost something Lynchian because there's just a lot of weird non sequitur moments where you're like, what was that about? And
like there's a moment at the restaurant where he sees somebody across the restaurant and he has a fantasy of her growling at him and then she isn't. Yeah. And it's like, what is this? And it never is explained or quantified later on. It just is a weird, as you say, Lynchian moment.
Yeah, I think it just tries to put you on edge and it wants to create this sinister atmosphere. But, you know, Jim Cummings and PJ McCabe aren't David Lynch. Like, they're never going to come anywhere close to that. It feels like a weird thing to try to do. It was pretty much entirely unsuccessful for me.
It's a shame because I really want the erotic thriller to kind of come back as a genre.
You'll get that with Deep Water, we're being promised. Okay. Ben Affleck and Ana de Armas, we're getting that.
God, that's going to be an awkward promotional tour.
Yes. Isn't it?
But pretty good move to show up to something with your ex with Jennifer Lopez on your arm, though.
Yeah. Anna is amazing and one of the best things in the Bond film, so not too shabby.
She is amazing in everything that she does. I love her. She's a fantastic Blade Runner and Knives Out. Only good things for Ana de Armas.
Yes. But we digress, which shows you how much this film has made an impression on us. This is the beta test, and it's out in cinemas on Friday. Right, so before we go, we should mention that the new issue is on sale with Ghostbusters Afterlife on the cover. Jordan spoke to everybody about this film. I've seen it. I reviewed it. 4 stars, people. Don't listen to the 1-star reviews. It's a 4-star movie. Jordan, tell us a bit about what they had to say about this film.
Well, yeah, Bustin made me feel good as well. I would agree with your review entirely. I spoke to Jason Reitman, the writer-director, Carrie Coon. You subbed in for me and spoke to Paul Rudd, Jane.
I did. I always love having a chat with Paul Rudd.
Yep. Finn Wolfhard from Stranger Things, of course, spoke to all of them. They were all terrific. Ghostbusters Afterlife is a really interesting film in the sense that Jason Reitman has essentially taken over the reins from his own father, Ivan Reitman, who directed the first 2 Ghostbusters films, of course. And this is very much a film that's sort of keeping it in the family. Like, it feels like there's a lot of heart in this film. It feels like they've made it with a lot of passion and care and attention. It's quite a different film from the original two Ghostbusters films. It's not straight comedy. It has that 80s Amblin vibe, and that was something that they very much sort of embraced on the set. It's a family story first and foremost. And I love the fact that the main character in it is this 12-year-old girl, Phoebe, who is the granddaughter of Egon Spengler. And you can very much sort of see that in McKenna Grace's performance. I really loved her, and she was great. Terrific to talk to. Yeah, she's so impassioned about Ghostbusters. She's been a fan since she was about 3 or 4 years old and used to carry around like a Slimer bath toy with her everywhere. And, you know, so it's a proper like dream come true for her to even be in a Ghostbusters film. And there were some great stories about, you know, rebuilding the Ecto-1 because it's something they had to do from scratch. There's so few of those. I think it's a 1959 Cadillac I may have got that wrong.
But it's also like the ambulance hearse model. So those are very
exactly,
tricky to come
up. So they would only make like 100 of those every year, and they had to like kind of track one down and rebuild it from scratch. And they filmed, you know, for real and in Canada. It was actually filmed in Canada, even though it's set in the Midwest, and they built this kind of Spengler mansion in the middle of nowhere. And it's this incredible kind of gothic towering creation with all these kind of aerials stuck on the top, which is obviously very reminiscent of all the random technology that's stuck on top of the Ecto-1. So yeah, it sounds like it was a really fun shoot. You know, there are some big things at the end of this film, which we kind of talked around a little bit because you don't want them spoiled. But I think everyone knows that the OG Ghostbusters are back in this film in some form. I'm not saying how, but it sounds like the shoot at the end was incredibly emotional for everyone involved. And they all have very good Bill Murray stories.
Who doesn't?
Of course, exactly. Finn Wolfhard was talking about the fact that he sat down for a couple of hours talking to him about a music festival he was about to attend. Didn't bother talking about acting, just talked about the bands that they liked, which made me love Bill Murray even more.
Yeah. So also in the issue, we're celebrating Harry Potter, 20 years since that first came out.
That makes me feel old.
And The Power of the Dog, The Card Counter, The Matrix Resurrections. Yeah. We're also talking to Kenneth Branagh, Jamie Lee Curtis, Lin-Manuel Miranda, Lisa Vikander, and Benedict Cumberbatch. I mean, it's a stuffed old issue. And Layla, what are you doing in it?
Well, I was writing up some of the festival highlights of the recent festival season that we've just gone through. And then I was talking to the director of Old Henry all about Westerns. And I'm in there with a few reviews, I think.
Yes,
God, it's kind of like everything. It's very hard to keep track because it's just been such a kind of amazing few months for releases, I think. Like, and even like that Power of the Dog, like I had a moment then where it's just like, I can't believe I forgot about Power of the Dog. That is Benedict Cumberbatch's best performance, definitely. And I hope that film gets a lot of awards. But yeah, great issue. Great films out at the moment.
So grab it. It's on newsstand today. And you can get it, read it, enjoy it. Okay, so before we go, we do have a reader's question. And this is, you know, quite an ethical one. Should we be making movies featuring dead people's likenesses when we can't get their consent? So I guess this is a question about, you know, bringing back the Donald Pleasance in Halloween Kills. But, you know, even as, you know, doing the Star Wars folk that we brought back to life digitally, is it ethically correct? And is it a something that we're going to get into problems going down the line? Layla, what do you reckon?
I don't like it, if I'm honest. I think it's sort of a little on the creepy side, and not particularly in ways that it's been used so far, but it just feels very slippery slope to me. And I read the news the other day of someone who's still alive, but Bruce Willis has like signed off on deep fakes of him being used for advert campaigns, which is, you know, probably about as good as Bruce Willis' performances are at the moment anyway.
But he can have even less to do with it, can't he? Because he seems to just loathe actually having to get involved in any of this. So now he just gets the check and doesn't have to leave the house.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously, that's not a consent issue because he is deciding to do that. But I just don't like the idea of this. And kind of, you know, even when they had that Tupac hologram and there was an idea of that was going to go on tour, or Whitney Houston that they were going to go on tour, I just think that this is getting slightly ghoulish. And so far, no film that I've seen has really used it in a way that I found particularly disturbing. But I just think going forward, I can see this all getting quite dark and Black Mirror episode.
Mm. Jordan, what do you reckon?
It's pretty cut and dry that if there's no consent, then they shouldn't be doing it, right? But they have to get consent for the likenesses from somewhere. So there is consent somewhere along that chain, I guess. It depends what context it's used in for me. I didn't have a huge issue with bringing Peter Cushing back for Rogue One, for example. It was almost an extension of his performance in that original film, even though Peter Cushing isn't here to give that performance. De-aging Carrie Fisher for that film, again, I didn't have a huge issue with, because it felt like you were just getting another glimpse at what Leia would have been like at that time. But there was this talk a couple of years ago about digitally resurrecting James Dean for a war movie.
Yeah.
And that felt incredibly icky. That was very much like a stunt thing almost, where you were like, James Dean's going to be in our film. Like, he was never connected to this film. Everyone involved in the making of this film probably wasn't even alive when James Dean died. Like, it was just very much the wrong thing to do as far as I'm concerned. But it becomes a little bit trickier when it's, you know, the family or the estate has given permission for someone's likeness to be used, but that person isn't around to explicitly say, I'm happy for this to have happened, you know, then it gets a little bit tricky. The example of Donald Pleasance in Halloween Kills is an odd one, because that is an actor who looks a bit like him rather than a kind of digital recreation. It's almost like recasting. It's just another person who looks a bit like Donald Pleasance playing Dr. Loomis in that moment. That feels like it's a slightly different thing.
But I mean, yeah, I guess this sort of started, didn't it, with even as far back as Gladiator, with
Oliver Reed
dying mid-shoot and then using a digital version of him to finish the scenes. Mm. And that feels fine, because he consented to those scenes. Yeah. He knew those were the scenes he was intending to play. And as you say, it feels okay if you're using performances within the genre that they originally intended, like a Cushing. But then there is a film that we could discuss that we can't yet, that has done this with somebody who is dead, and it's within the genre, but it is an entirely different thing. And we can probably safely assume they'd like it, but they haven't actually said yes. And then you start to think about, like, I remember that Galaxy advert with Audrey Hepburn, like, in the Amalfi Coast. I imagine that Audrey didn't enjoy a Galaxy, but like, where does it end? It could be something that, if people get so used to this idea that we can just reanimate people, then why don't we? And yeah, it is a ethically quite dodgy ground. And I don't want dead people doing weird things as well. You know, like, I want my Marilyn Monroe and my Audrey Hepburn and my James Dean doing those classic things that they did in their lifetime when they're so alive in those films. I don't want them breaking out of those perfect capsules they're in. I don't think they should be.
They always just look weird as well, because, you know, the visual effects aren't there for photorealistic humans yet. So you always get these like weird, morph, disturbing looking versions
uncanny
of these
valley.
Iconic Hollywood actors, which just makes it even worse. Like, it's just a very bizarre thing to do.
If you rewatched Forrest Gump recently, that has not aged well to the modern eye. And they kind of have, you know, John Lennon saying a few things. It's really, really bad.
I remember that looking incredible back
in the day. I remember it felt like, you cannot tell, but probably we'd now watch it and go, you really can.
You really, like, really can. Not since Ben Affleck was blonde was I so disturbed by something on my screen.
I've been wondering for a long time if they're going to bring back Paul Walker for like a Fast and Furious film as well. I feel like that's something that they're building towards with those films.
Absolutely.
Which obviously they did it a bit in Furious 7, Fast and Furious 7, because he died in the middle of that shoot.
Yes. And they used his brother, didn't they?
Exactly. But it's a character they sort of kept alive in the universe. And he sort of exists on the periphery. And you'll know if you've seen the more recent film that he's very much hinted at as sort of being there, but just off camera. So I don't know how I would feel about that, because I feel like if you asked Paul Walker, he'd probably be fine.
He'd totally
with it,
be into obviously. It, I think.
You just can't know. So, yeah, what do you do?
Well, sometimes people do turn down surprising sequels. Like, I was very, like, I remember it being quite shocking that, like, Jodie Foster refused to be in Hannibal and stuff like that. I think you can't always predict that, like, sometimes people will just be like, no, I don't want to do another one of these.
Well, I think the way it's going to have to go, isn't it, that people who might have their likeness used are going to have wills that extend into the artistic license of their likeness. And they're going to have to put down and say, yeah, I'm into sci-fi and I'd do something as long as it was about this, but I don't want to be involved in this. I'd never work with this director. I don't ever want to play a fireman, and please don't ever have me do this. And I really don't want to sell any of these products, but I would be okay with Galaxy. And they're going to have to think of all of the ways that they might be used and be very specific about it, so that if in the future somebody does want to make James Dean, you know, in a sci-fi film about alien eggs, though there would be a document that said, no, definitely didn't want to do that, would only be interested in, you know, this. And that's probably the way it's going to go, isn't it?
That would be a really good film that would be better than the beta test.
There you go. Let's just write an email to Jim Cummings. Here we go.
There is that film, isn't there? The Robin Wright one.
Oh, yeah. Oh, ahead of its time.
Yeah.
Robin Wright, very underserved as in the roles that she gets. I will die on that hill.
She is great in land. Okay, we should stop gabbing because it's time to go. Let's say adieu, or in whatever accent you'd like to, in the last duel fashion, and say goodbye to everybody.
Farewell.
Bye.
And it's goodbye from me. We will see you next week. Goodbye.